This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn with me, Dashran Johan. Recently, there's been plenty of investigations done on journalists, media outlets, and even opposition MPs regarding their reporting or opinions on the untimely deaths of people while in police custody. The most prominent incident in recent times is, of course, the death of A. Ganapathy, a 40-year-old milk trader who was allegedly beaten while in police custody in Gomba. So joining me on the show today to discuss the changes that we need to see in the police force, as well as the importance of safeguarding press freedom, is Katrina Jorin Maliamau, the Executive Director of Amnesty International Malaysia, and Ding Jo Ann, Legal Researcher and Advisor at the Center for Independent Journalism. Welcome to the show, guys. How are y'all doing?
Hi, doing okay. Under the circumstances.
That is exactly what it is, trying to be as okay as we can under the circumstances.
Yeah, definitely. So let's get into it. Katrina, recently Amnesty International Malaysia and a bunch of other MGOs signed and released a statement condemning the outgoing Gomba police chief, Arifai Tarawe's threat to sue media outlet Free Malaysia Today. What can you tell us about this?
So the statement came out last week, and it's I think at the time we sent it, there were 12 groups that had signed on, and then now it's, I believe, at 17. So kind of some context here and what the statement captures, right? Earlier this year, in February, A. Ganapathy, as you said, was arrested, and he was arrested to assist police investigations into his brother. In March, his family received a call from the police informing them that he had been released but was admitted to Selayang Hospital's ICU. On March 11th, Ganapathy's mother, Tana Lichmi, she lodged a police report claiming that her son had been beaten while in custody. You know, she said that her son told her that he had been beaten with a rubber hose, that he had been then dragged on the road. In one account, I'd heard her say that. And really, I mean, some of the images that have been put out there are so difficult to see and really, really horrifying. And then on April 18th, he died in hospital. And so that's sort of the kind of the background context of this case that has sparked so much outrage. The family gave a really heartbreaking interview with DJ, I think his name is Shankar, where the mother and the sister spoke about the grief and the pain that they're in. Justice for Ganapathy has been trending. A change.org petition as of this morning that when I looked at it, demanding justice and action, and the IPCMC has almost 160,000 signatures. And so that's kind of the context where people are trying to make sense, and they're responding to this really violent thing that allegedly happened, right, in police custody. And you know, what's not alleged there, but real is the fact that he's died, and we need answers. And so what has been the response of the police? Like you said, the outgoing Gomba police chief, Arifai Tarawi's, he didn't just start by making the threat against Free Malaysia Today, right. But on April 30th, when, Justice for Ganapathy was trending and there was just so much commentary, he warned the public against commenting or making videos and posting them on social media regarding A. Ganapathy's death. You know, what he said is, we're not meant to make baseless comments and to racialize the whole situation as it may hamper investigations. And quoting him, and this is from, I think, the Malay Mail article, he said, "If you want to do it, quote someone with authority. If you still want to do it, then don't do it in a way that will make people angry, worried, or annoyed. This is not a racial issue, and people, if they persist, will be prosecuted by the law." And then on 18th May, a month after Ganapathy's death, two Malaysia Kini journalists were questioned, and I think another one was also called up. Over reports, Malaysia Kini news reports on the case. The investigations, I understand it, are under Section 505B of the Penal Code, which penalises those who make remarks, and I'm quoting the law here, with intent to cause, or which is likely to cause, fear or alarm to the public or to any section of the public whereby a person may be induced to commit an offence against the state or against public tranquility, end quote. Right. And I think, I just want us to hold that thought, right? So the reporting of a death in resulting from alleged beatings by the police is the thing that's causing the public tranquility to be added? Is that what the suggestion is?
Right.
Here? 2 days later, on 20th May, Gombak Police Chief Rafi then threatened to sue Free Malaysia Today for 10 million ringgit over two articles they wrote. He's going to be transferred to Bukit Aman, and I believe to the department that is meant to look into integrity and compliance. And in the article where they talked about this transfer, they gave background information about Ganapati's death. Given the fact that it was under the jurisdiction of the Gombak police. And so what we see here really is a pattern of the police using their authority, might, their power, in an attempt to silence the public, right?
Right. You know,
we have a fundamental right to express ourselves. We have a demand. We have the right to demand for justice and answers. And I think what we are saying collectively is that it's completely unacceptable for these threats to be made against the public, against journalists. When this is going on, when we talk about, you know, Malaysian Indians are speaking about their racialized experiences, they talk about the kind of violence and discrimination they endure just by being, you know, ethnic minorities, and let alone the cases of abuse by the authorities, we have a right to be heard. And to try and muzzle us, to tell us that our acts of public grieving and questioning and seeking justice is the disruption of peace and not the violence itself. I mean, that's really, it's unconscionable, you know, if you really think about it.
Right. Now, Katrina, before we get into the suppression of our freedom to express ourselves, let's talk about death in police custody, or, you know, police brutality in general. Has this always been a problem in Malaysia? And like you mentioned, you know, some authorities will tell you not to racialize the issue, but in your perspective, and, you know, when we look at the stats throughout the years, is there an issue of systemic racism that is at play here as well?
Right. So I think, I mean, firstly, statistics are, they don't just sort of exist in a vacuum. And I think we need to ask really, how is it being measured?
Right.
How is there comprehensive data being collected to begin with on victims of police brutality? Are we just looking at deaths in custody? Mm-hmm. What are the assessments of violence that we're using, you know? And because what people are saying is really it's a whole spectrum of ways in which the police and people in authority seem to be violating our rights or not acting when our rights are violated. And so these conversations have been going on for decades, right? This question of police violence, police lack of accountability, a lack of independent investigations. And, you know, the IPCMC, which was proposed by the Royal Commission, was 16 years ago. And,
right.
And we still cannot seem to bring it to fruition. I mean, the statistics. So I think I wanted to give a background in, like, we're even measuring it, because my understanding is that the majority of statistics that we get come through parliamentary replies or news articles when they're reported. I know Swaram, the Malaysian Human Rights Organization, is probably one of the main organizations that is documenting these cases. So, like, some of the numbers, right, that we see from, and this is a parliamentary reply in March of 2017,
okay,
which said that between 2002 and 2016, there were 257 deaths in police custody. Okay, so we have
right.
that one number.
Okay.
And then in Swaram's report that came out this year, they had documented at least 8 cases of deaths in custody in 2020. And then we have last year, there was a statistic that said there were 214 people who have died in lockups, prisons and immigration depots in the first 6 months of 2020. And this is from the Home Ministry. Mm. And so the stats show that, you know, whether it is, it's both looking at how many people and again, I want to ask who's measuring it without, like, so, you know, independent investigations, when the media sort of not feeling free to report on it when Parliament isn't in session. Where are we meant to get that data and clarity on data, disaggregated data? And then secondly, I think it is, whether it is one death or eight deaths or 100 deaths, they're all terrible. And the fact that not just that people are dying, but there doesn't seem to be an investigation that is independent and transparent and open to the public also adds to sort of this question of the prevalence and the gravity of the situation, right? And kind of the impunity that emerges. Now, and the question of racism and mm-hmm. systematic discrimination. So I think I don't have the numbers at the top of my head, but I understand from Swaram's reporting also that the given, you know, the number of Malaysian Indians in Malaysia and the number of deaths that we are seeing of allegations of police brutality by Indians, it is disproportionate. And I know that some investigations, you know, say, or some reporting will say that, oh, that's because that it is proportionate because the number of Indians arrested or for committing crimes is much higher than others. Even if you take that argument and you say that the number of people in police lockups are who are Indian are higher than others, let's even ask why that is, you know?
Right.
There cannot be an assumption that Malaysian Indians are inherently more susceptible to committing crimes. That would be a very poor racial analysis. And so I think that we are long overdue for a really thorough, systematic grappling of what race and race relations is like in this country. And when you see people talk about their experiences of their racialized experiences of harassment and discrimination as Malaysian Indians, as dark-skinned people, as ethnic minorities, now, even if the statistics may not, you know, we don't have official stats, I think all these stories, you know, anecdotes are data points also, and they should be taken seriously. And we shouldn't shut it down by saying, oh, you know, where's the official report that captures all of it? Because the fact that there isn't an official report, despite what people are saying, is also a cause of concern, you know? At what point are we going to be taken seriously? At what point does the even the feeling of pervasive discrimination matter enough that it's there's action and accountability and justice?
Hmm. Joanne, when we look at, you know, the issues of police brutality, death in police custody, what changes do we need to see moving forward to prevent these things from happening? Why does it keep happening?
Well, I think there are a few changes that need to happen. It could be down to even, you know, structural issues like training in interrogation methods. You know, very often you see the same kinds of injuries occurring, right? External bruises and then internal injuries, beatings, you know, leading to kidney failure or heart failure. So why is it that these beatings are occurring in these cases? And what kind of training do the police receive in what kind of methods they should employ in interrogation?
Right.
Things like CCTVs in lockups. I think a few years ago it was found that a lot of them were found to be not working. So that needs to be looked into, you know, so that these lockups can be reviewed by CCTV. And then the whole practice of chain remand, where, you know, people keep getting arrested again and again, and they are kept for many days by the police. So that needs to be looked into as well. And the rights of the accused, you know, having the right to a lawyer when they have been arrested, you know, giving them access, so to speak, to the outside world. And of course, you know, to risk sounding like a broken record, since, as Katrina said, this has been an issue for 16 years,
right,
we need to have the IPCMC, an independent, transparent, accountable mechanism to investigate cases of police brutality and deaths in custody. When we look back, there have been so few cases where the police have actually been charged and successfully convicted. I can actually only think of one in the case of A. Coogan, where a police officer was charged, not even for culpable homicide or murder, but for causing hurt. And he was jailed for 3 years, and Coogan died in 2009. And there were police that were acquitted in the death of Damendran and also in the death of Syed Azlan. So there are so few cases where police officers who have been involved in the deaths of those in custody have been found accountable, even when the EAIC has directly drawn a link between their actions and death and the death of the person in custody. Even then, there is no accountability. And we don't know what happens internally in the JIPS, the Jabatan Integrity, you know. We don't know whether they're disciplined. We don't know how they're disciplined. It's all very opaque. So that is why we need an independent and transparent mechanism like the IPCMC to look into these cases and to bring some accountability to these cases, to send a message that this is serious. You cannot do this and get away with it. And I'm sure it is in the interest of the police force as well that they are seen to be taking these issues seriously. And that will help to build public trust in the institution.
Definitely. But well, what's the holdback, Joanne? Because it seems like the IPCMC, just like the, you know, sexual harassment bill, it's been, you know, pushed for more than a decade, but nothing seems to be coming of it. Well, what's the holdback when it comes to the IPCMC?
Well, I think we have to acknowledge that this is a political hot potato. The police themselves were historically resistant because they were unsure about what kind of form this independent commission would take. Would this mean that, you know, for anything and everything, they're going to be hauled up to the commission? What about anonymous, you know, complaints and things like that? But during the Pakatan Harapan's tenure, we actually got together with the police, with stakeholders, with families of victims, with civil society, with lawyers, and we all sat down and they came up with a bill, which admittedly is not perfect, but was one that was kind of cobbled out, you know, after many, many rounds of consultation and discussion. And we came up with something that, you know, everyone was not entirely happy with, but could live with. And it was on the cusp of being passed, even although there was still opposition. But then the Sheraton move took over. And I can tell you that this government is not interested in implementing the IPCMC. And I say this because I have seen their IPCC bill, which was put up for consideration last year in place of the IPCMC bill. PN's IPCC bill is a far inferior version that will put us back more than a decade, as it gives this IPCC even less powers than the current EAIC. And all sorts of loopholes for the police to refuse to answer questions if they choose to do so. So it seems like this government has only listened to the police, and maybe not even the grassroots police, but only a certain section of the police, and has ignored all other considerations, and they are not interested in putting forward the IPCMC bill. So it is up to the public to demand for it, to ask for it, and to put pressure on the government to ensure that this becomes a reality.
And how does the public demand for it and put pressure?
Well, in all the ways that they know how, in every small way that you do, whether you write, whether you speak, whether you have to protest, whether you have to, you know, do public education, talk to the media, which is why the media is so important in highlighting issues like this. Right. To educate yourself even on this topic. Some people may not be aware about the seriousness of this situation and these issues. So there are many ways for the public to get involved.
All right. On that note, we do need to go for a very quick break. On the show with me today are Katrina Jorin Maliamau of Amnesty International Malaysia and Ding Joanne, a legal researcher and advisor at the Center for Independent Journalism. And we're talking about death in police custody as well as free speech on Live and Learn BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today via Zoom are Katrina Jorin Maliamau of Amnesty International Malaysia and Ding Joanne, a legal researcher and an advisor at the Center for Independent Journalism. And we are talking about death in police custody as well as free speech. Now, Katrina, you sense a growing sense of frustration among the people. You can see that on social media every single day. Many, including YB Saitsadeh, have asked why the police are investigating those who speak up and criticize instead of, you know, actually trying to solve the problem of death in police custody. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think some of it picks up on what Joanne was just talking about, right? And on why, what is the holdback for preventing sort of this, even the IPCMC from coming into fruition. And people are, of course, they're frustrated with many things, right? So our we can see, you know, like I said earlier, even if we cannot name, you know, fundamental human rights, and we don't know what the structures of international human rights law and all of that, language aside, we know what it feels to live in our bodies, to live in this world, to experience harm, to see the right to life being threatened, and seemingly no action taken. We know what it's like to see torture and having it dismissed or excused, and that's frustrating. You know, this is also, I think, the context of when we talk about policing. We cannot just look at count death in custodies as just one a measure. You know, you have to look at all the other issues and how the police are behaving in Malaysia. What are the other issues that have come up? So people can see, for example, all the investigations into human rights defenders, people being hauled up for tweets that they're posting. We can see it. And we know this is not correct. And I think maybe now, you know, the time when there are police checkpoints everywhere, and even the proximity of police closer to us in our everyday life is there. We are experiencing what it feels like to, more of us, I should say, are experiencing what it feels like to have a police force that seemingly doesn't have our interests. And so we have to ask, who are they protecting? What are they serving? Whose interests are they serving? So, you know, the question of what is holding back, but also who is holding back, I think matters. There needs to be a strong counterforce to that sense of impunity that has been embedded, I think, in our institutions. And so I don't think that we are going to just get this shift overnight, because there's a realization now that the police should be better. I think that it is systematic. I think that the pressure from elected representatives needs to be very strong, certainly from the public, because this is not a question of the authorities not knowing that there's a problem. It's not a question of, oh, we don't know what the solutions are. You know what the solutions are, because the Royal Commission told you 16 years ago. Right. And for 16 years, human rights organizations and lawyers and families of victims and victims themselves have told you what we need to do. There has been incredible generosity from human rights organizations, from lawyers saying, look, we will work with you on the IPCMC. You want to know how to structure this? We'll give you the information. So this is not a situation of not knowing. And so our question then is, why aren't you implementing it? What are you gaining from the status quo? Who benefit from the way things are right now? If all of us, if a whole bunch of us, I shouldn't say all of us, are experiencing the harm and witnessing the harm, there seem to be others who are not. And why are they so unmoved? Why doesn't it matter when violence is happening, not just in our midst, but the people that were put in charge to apparently address violence?
Now, Joanne, when we look at the, you know, issues of freedom of speech, why is freedom of speech, especially when it comes to freedom of the press, why is it important in these circumstances especially?
Well, those in authority wield great power in all our lives. I think this is especially evident now in these times of COVID, where we can be locked down and confined to our homes or districts just at the stroke of a pen.
That's right.
So what protects society from abuse, you know, of these powers? So there must be checks and balances, Parliament being one of them, the judiciary, and for sure, a free and independent media. So if the government or those in authority misuse their power, then the media must be free to act in the public interest and expose those practices. If they are not allowed to do so, then what will protect us from tyranny? The media's job is not to protect the interests of those in power. it is to act in the public interest. And we have seen too many instances of a lack of media freedom resulting in damage to real lives. Take Wuhan in 2019, for example, when a doctor in December 2019, which sounds like an age ago, tried to warn others about the dangers of this new coronavirus. And then exactly. The authorities tried to intimidate that doctor. Not tried, the authorities did intimidate him and told him to stop talking and got him to sign a statement saying that he would do so. And right. We can only imagine how different our lives would be, you know? Our last 1.5 years would be if the media had reported on this story in December 2019 rather than later.
Exactly.
So, this is just an example of real lives being impacted because, you know, free speech was curtailed. And if you take that to the police, for example, you know, they have huge powers over the people. So the media must be free to report when there are instances of abuse of this authority, to keep that authority in check. This is our social contract, so to speak, you know. Mm-hmm. We allow them to have this authority, but only on the condition that we must be allowed to question that authority when they go beyond their bounds. And there must be mechanisms in place to do so.
But Joanne, you know, the authorities you're talking about, they might argue that giving, you know, us, the media, you know, too much freedom will then allow the media to cause public distrust towards institutions such as the police, which is then a security issue, which could lead to anarchy and so on and so forth. These are the kinds of arguments they bring up, right? How would you respond to that?
Well, this is a common argument used by those in power. You know, right. We often hear, don't talk bad about Malaysia because it will give people a bad perception about Malaysia, you know. There is only so far you can go to paper over the cracks. If there are serious issues that need fixing, you can insist you want to live in cloud cuckoo land and that things are going fine. But sooner or later, these issues will come to the surface and will do a lot more harm if you keep quiet about it than if you could bring them up early on. It's like COVID in a factory, let's say, right? Mm-hmm. If you do a lot of testing early on and you find the cases and isolate them, then you only have 10 cases. But if you pretend that everything is okay, even though it's ravaging, you know, amongst your community, then in 1 month's time or in, you know, 2 months' time, you have a serious, serious issue on your hands. This is the same thing. If there are serious issues, then the media must be able to do their job.
That's right.
And calling up the media for investigation when they are just doing their job and reporting facts creates a lot of public distrust towards the police. Mm-hmm. Look, the first question that's going to come to people's mind is, wow, why so serious? You know, what do they have to hide? You know, until they are calling right. in journalists, surely there is something fishy going on here. So who then is creating public distrust? Is it the journalists or is it the authorities who are calling up the journalists for just reporting on facts? This is something that, you know, has to be ruminated on by those in authorities.
Certainly.
I mean, I think this idea, and like Joanne said, we're constantly being told that when we name the violence, our naming of it is an aggressive act, is a disruption of peace, not the violence itself. If you don't want distrust, behave in a way that is trusting and trustworthy. You know, and I think that's it's very basic. And we know what this is in our everyday relationships, right? If we had a friend, if we had somebody in our community that seemed to be always committing acts that were painful and harmful, us talking about it isn't the problem here. It's the acts that are committing harm. And I think that, you know, we should trust our intuition and our instincts when we see that this is a problem, and also understand the power dynamics here. So people in power have long sought to make sure that those they have power over cannot speak out in ways that question their authority or try and rein in some of that power or hold them accountable. And so the power dynamics here, you know, that exist, even with being called up for questioning, I think that may seem innocuous to some, like, oh, but not arrested, but just called up for questioning. That is that the power differential when you are in that space is pretty great. And it's a form of intimidation. It's a form of harassment. And I think we, you know, when you ask the question about what the public needs to do, part of it is collectively trying to overcome sort of the fear that we have internalized, and with good reason, because we see over and over again people being hauled up for using their right to freedom of expression. You know, That's so the right. free media, very important, but also for the public, you know, that we really do have a right to tell our stories and to ask questions and to state when we feel uncomfortable. And there cannot be an active, healthy democracy without expression. There just cannot be, because any kind of system of check and balance will immediately crumble, you know, when there's no free speech. And also kind of overcoming our own internalized censorship and the own restrictions of expression that we put in ourselves in order to try and, you know, maybe not be too disruptive, to not bump up against power. I think we have to create spaces for each other to tell those stories. And it's been so encouraging to see you know, at least on social media right now, people doing that, you know, people saying and name their harms and affirming each other. And I think we just need more of that in offline spaces also.
Certainly. But, you know, the thing about freedom of speech is that freedom of speech doesn't mean freedom of consequences, right? So with that in mind, some might also argue that, you know, Gombak Police Chief Arifai Tarawe's threat, for example, to sue media outlet Free Malaysia Today is fine, because if he's suing FMT, then he'll need to provide evidence in the court, etc. And this is indeed the proper way to challenge allegedly false reporting, as compared to draconian laws like Sedition Act and so on and so forth. What are your thoughts on this?
There are defamation suits and there are defamation suits, yeah? Mm-hmm. So an individual is entitled to defend their good reputation if false accusations are made against them, which damages them, right?
That's right.
The media cannot irresponsibly publish harmful rumors or gossip about an individual without first verifying those claims. But if the media is publishing facts that are in the public interest, especially regarding a public official, then that public official must not misuse the law of defamation. The law of defamation is not there to make a public official feel better about themselves or to insist that media only portrays them in a complimentary way. To threaten to sue and to claim millions in damages when a media outlet is just publishing facts could be tantamount to intimidation of the media and forcing them to face expensive lawsuits which have little basis in law. So there is a definition, and we need to call out these instances of intimidation when they do occur. So while there is a place for defamation suits in our legal universe, it is not meant for public officials to use to intimidate those who are just doing their job in the media.
All right. Okay, before we wrap up this conversation, I would like both your takes on this. What changes do we need to see moving forward so that media in Malaysia is empowered and free? Let's start with you, Joanne.
Well, it's an old ask, but I would want the Printing Presses and Publications Act to be dismantled, and for the government to assist and facilitate the setting up of a media council by the media themselves, where the press are self-regulatory and they can set ethical standards for themselves. So they can hear complaints from the public or from the authorities if they feel that they are, you know, being vilified. And if they feel that the media has breached those standards, then an inquiry can be held and a decision can be made based on ethical standards, not on political considerations, which seems to be the case now. And then the media can be asked to make corrections or apologies if found to be in breach, or the complainant can be told there was no breach. So that would help a lot. I think we also need a Right to Information Act. The government's authorities should know that the public information that they hold belongs to the public, does not belong to them, and should only be withheld in exceptional circumstances and not the other way around. And finally, we also need a recalibration of our laws so that they are more respectful of the freedom of expression and there is less room for abuse by those in authority, less room to use our laws like Section 233 of the CMA, which is so wide that you can investigate any individual or even the media when the government feels that they have been portrayed negatively.
Katrina?
No, completely agree with everything that Joanne said. I the Printing Presses and Publications Act has to go. I mean, the views of the CMA to sort of curtail, especially online expression. I think that there's a whole climate of laws that are used to restrict expression in Malaysia, and the media is certainly not exempt from it. I'd urge you to listeners to go to our website, unsilenced.amnesty.my, to look through and to get a sense of the ways in which, you know, the sort of the tentacles of the law have been used to silence our people, including the media. I think that we need more boldness from people who've been elected and others in power to name what they're seeing as these forms of censorship and intimidation. I think we should support, independent media. We should support journalists. We, as Malaysians, need to reflect deeply on sort of the importance of the media here. I can understand if people have been feeling discouraged over time, because of sort of the ways in which the media have been used or been silenced. But we have to really, understand and believe how fundamental the role of the media is to protecting our human rights. And I think that, this is going to take persistence. It's going to take us really believing that there can be another way. another world is possible, that mm-hmm. people in power can be pushed to protect our rights, that institutions that may seem like they are hopelessly embedded with impunity can change. And as Malaysians, we really have to believe in our power to push for that change, despite what our experiences have been and despite what we're told.
Something that Malaysians can do, just to add in, is to subscribe to to independent media.
Right.
Support independent media by subscribing. And a lot of people feel they don't want to pay for content, but if you are not paying for the content online, then the content is you. Then the product is you. Mm-hmm. Somehow your data or your persona is being used by the people in question, or they want to send you a message or influence you. So if the content needs to be paid for, that's a good sign, and we should sign up to such content sometimes.
Certainly, certainly. And with that, Katrina, Joanne, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That was Katrina Joreen Maliamau of Amnesty International Malaysia and Ding Joanne, legal researcher and advisor at Centre for Independent Journalism, talking to me about police brutality, death in police custody, as well as free speech. Why is it important? So if you missed any part of this conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app and on BFM.my. You've been listening to Live and Learn with me, Dashran Johan, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.